This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a demand for freedom for members of the MOVE organization who've been imprisoned for the past 39 years. And has the reparations movement hit a legal dead end? No, says an activist who's pushing to put reparations on the ballot in Chicago.
But first, James Forman Jr., the son of the legendary civil rights leader, has caused quite a stir with his new book titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. Forman is a professor at Yale Law School. His new book details how during the 1970s and 80s, Black politicians pushed for draconian drug laws and policing strategies that resulted in the massive rate of incarceration in Black America. We spoke with Paul Street, a historian and author who has done extensive research on mass incarceration. Street is quite impressed with James Forman's work.
I read this book. At first, I thought he was a historian because it's just first-class archival primary source historical research behind most of these chapters. I mean, he hit the archives and newspapers and the whole thing. It's a beautiful book. It's an extremely eloquent and well-written book. I wanted to mention that while he had an elite law school degree, I'm assuming an Ivy League law school degree, he chose to spend his early legal career as a public defender, and a public defender in Washington, D.C., where he kept experiencing again and again, watching his clients get sent away. Juvenile clients to really bad juvenile incarceration institutions. Adult ones to even worse institutions. Often enough by Black prosecutors and by Black judges. And, of course, it's Washington, D.C. with a majority Black population. And since the civil rights movement, you do have a lot of Black middle class upper class personnel in the criminal justice system there. And I think a light bulb went off in his head about the role of Black elites in the rise of the mass incarceration system. And it turns out that's kind of a giant hole in the literature. And it turns out that that's very much a book that was waiting to be written. I think that probably the best book we've ever had about the rise of racist mass incarceration is Michelle Alexander's Tour de Force, The New Jim Crow, which I believe came out around 2010. One of the issues that it did have with its title, The New Jim Crow, is that the real Jim Crow system, as it operated in the late 19th century up through the 20th century, was kind of specific to the South. I mean, there was a de facto Jim Crow outside of the South, but the real, true, legal Jim Crow system was specific to the South and applied to pretty much all African Americans, regardless of class. Whereas the mass incarceration system, which is also a felony marking system, it's also a criminal marking system, is a little bit more class specific and a little more specifically targeting the Black working and the Black lower and the Black so-called underclass. So that's sort of a problem with the use of the metaphor, the analogy of Jim Crow. But what Forman does in this book is go beyond just how the Black middle class is exempted. Not completely, but largely exempted from the mass incarceration felony marking regime. Beyond just that exemption, many ordinary working class Black voters in the 70s and 80s and since have actively participated in and supported the war on crime and the racially disparate war on crime and racially disparate war on drugs that ended up producing racist mass incarceration. This insane situation we have right now with 1 million or more Black people behind bars and one of every three Black adult males carrying the lifelong stigma of a felony record.
In Forman's book, he pays a great deal of attention to the growth in the number of Black folks who were police persons and prosecutors and such. There used to be only token numbers. There was an assumption, and I remember, that with more black police officers and more black officers of the court, that the criminal justice system would become more humane, especially towards black folks, rather than a punishing kind of punitive system. But it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, this is one of the things, according to Foreman, he documents this, that got the black folks willing in urban America, Washington, D.C., but get behind the lockdown. If you see more black faces in high positions in the criminal justice system, you see more black cops, see more black prosecutors, see more black justices, and all of that, that tended to kind of make it okay to get behind a sort of crackdown. And part of the background context for this is first the heroin epidemic of the 1960s and 70s and the crack epidemic concentrated in black urban neighborhoods in the 1980s. And so, yeah, this sort of the upgrading of the black presence in the system sort of tragically helps garner black support for the lockdown.
So that we have black politicians running on platforms of not just law and order, but lock them up and throw away the key. And some folks that we considered to be progressive, like Marion Barry and others in Washington.
Well, one thing that James Foreman Jr. really develops is what he considers a kind of tragedy of all of this. And I think he points out correctly that at first, and this is really even going back to the late 60s and up through the 70s, at first there's a kind of almost civil rights aura around getting behind law and order, because it becomes even something that some black nationalists in different American cities get behind. It becomes part of a thing that we've got so much crime in our own communities, that it is getting in the way of social justice, that it is becoming a problem for us having the movement for equality, and that there's almost a sense of crime in black America as a civil rights issue, and cracking down on crime as a pro-civil rights, pro-black kind of thing to be behind because of the ravages that crime is having on the south side of Chicago or in the west side of Chicago or the east side of Detroit or Harlem or what have you. There's also, at the beginning of all of this and in the early Marion Barry days, there's also what they would tell you, and I don't think they were lying, and I mean when I say they, I mean black elites, is they didn't just want the right hand of the state. They didn't just want the crackdown. They didn't want to just lock people up and throw away the key. They were also advocating for the expansion of the left hand of the state, and they were calling for a Marshall Plan for black America so that alongside increased policing and increased sentencing and mass incarceration, alongside that would have been jobs, would have been an expansion of social safety net, would have been investment in schools and medical services and all those things, all those services that urban black ghetto America lacked. They wanted that. You know, the tragedy of the whole thing, or the irony of the whole thing, or just the raw deal that came out of it, was all they got, and all black America has got as this story moved forward into the current era, all they got was the right hand of the state. They got the prison state. They got the repressive iron fist repression without the velvet glove of any expansion of the social welfare state. And, you know, the more the capitalist, racist, oppressive oppression system destroys and rips up the welfare state, the left hand of the state, the more people it kicks off of welfare as the Democrats and Republicans joined together in doing in the 1990s, unfortunately with the support of the Congressional Black Caucus, the more you tear up the left hand of the state, the more the system relies for social control on the right hand of the state, on the prison state and the police state. Those two are sort of ripping up welfare and expanding prisons are really two sides of the same vicious neoliberal coin.
So black folks got mass black incarceration, but never a Marshall Plan. And contemporaneously, these same leaders or the heirs to these leaders don't even ask for a Marshall Plan anymore.
Foreman's trying to be polite. He knows he's treading on sort of difficult ground here, touchy ground. Class is an underestimated issue. There are ideological divisions and class divisions within black America. He is, to some extent, calling out black elites for their pivotal and central and underestimated role in this incarceration system. But he tends, I think, in the book to kind of excuse it a little bit. At least, I think he does once you come up past the 1980s. I mean, at the origin point, at the beginning, I sort of get it. I can understand that they sort of got fooled. They thought they could advocate both of these things at the same time, a war on drugs, a war on crime, and a Marshall Plan for Black America. But, you know, by the 1990s, and by the time you've got Jesse Jackson Sr. and Oprah Winfrey and just a whole panoply of black elites, the very people that are just savagely criticized in Elaine Brown's brilliant book, The Condemnation of Little B, which is all about Atlanta and the black bourgeoisie and the black lower class in Atlanta. By the time you get to the 90s, it's pretty clear that this is a one-sided, right-handed, iron-fisted, right-wing, racist crackdown going on without any supplementary expansion of welfare at all. And in fact, the Clintons simultaneously in the mid-90s slash AFPC, eliminate the public family cash assistance entitlement for black and poor white families and others, while passing a three-strikes crime bill, which just drastically expands the federal investment in support for mass incarceration. And numerous black elites got behind that. I think by the 90s, there's no more excuses.
And one character whose thread runs throughout the book and into today's political era is Eric Holder, who was the first black U.S. attorney for D.C. and a real force in creating this mass black incarceration regime, with D.C. as the laboratory.
Right, and who then gets into history after quite a few years with a stint in corporate law and helping corporations avoid prosecution, becomes the nation's first black attorney general. And with a few exceptions, I've heard some nice things from liberal people in the criminal justice system that they're happy about some of the investigations that Holder initiated of, for instance, Ferguson, Missouri, and so forth, but really undertook no serious initiative to roll back mass incarceration. And for that matter, neither did the first black president, Barack Obama, beyond some very sort of symbolic and secondary kinds of things like visiting a federal prison and all that kind of business. As was always the case with Obama, symbolism outstripped deeds quite significantly. And by the way, that's very consistent with the state senator Obama that I saw when I was a research director at the Chicago Urban League in the early 20th century.
James Forman gives a lot of attention to, as you said, the heroin epidemic, followed by the crack cocaine epidemic. And he seems to say that the entire black community was traumatized by the shock of these epidemics, and that many in the community came to think of drug dealers, not just drug dealers, but the junkies themselves and a criminal element itself, as agents of the oppressor, that they saw fighting against the drug elements as part of the black upward mobility or black survival struggle.
Well, I mean, there was some basis. I mean, we had some in the 1980s. There did appear to have been some CIA involvement in the flooding of urban America with crack cocaine and all that. But yeah, that gives you kind of a civil rights justification in the sense that you're fighting the man and you're opposing racists at the same time that you're either wittingly or unwittingly, as the case may be, contributing to this plague. I mean, it just is just a cancer across the black population and the struggle for black equality right now, which is just this lifelong branding, these prison histories and these felony records that are just as vicious circle. So it all plays out in some very ugly and unappealing kinds of ways. And unfortunately, a lot of the black elites and some of the ordinary black voters that thought they had good reasons for getting behind this are probably looking back in retrospect and wondering about that. At least I would hope they would be.
Do you think there's some danger that right-wing elements, including black right-wing elements, might use James Forman's book as a justification for maintaining the mass black incarceration regime?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, that would be done how? What's the implication in that that would lead to that, perhaps?
Well, James Forman does make the case that at various junctures, lots of black voters, not just black demagogues and preachers, black
right.
voters went along with these draconian laws.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in other words, they could cite the book. Right. I had that same thought as I was reading it, that, you know, I could see a right-wing sort of Republican white nationalist type of Trumpian or whatever sort of saying, look, point to this thing, see, this has support. This lockdown has support in black America. You know, and unfortunately, there is some of that. It's naive to think that none of that exists. I remember when I came out with the study, when I was a research director at the Chicago Urban League, And we came out with a study that in some ways anticipated Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, and it was a study called The Vicious Circle, Race, Prison, and Jobs. And I was still sort of naive about this issue, this ideological and class division within Black America, because I went on Chicago Black Radio, WVON, this was an all-Black radio audience, and I'd say a third of the calls that came in were kind of hard-ass, because in the study I was making an argument for reentry and for the absurdity of marking people for life with a felony record, which means they couldn't get a job, which means they can't function in a capitalist society, which means you're just going to recycle back between poverty zip codes and prisons and poverty zip codes and prisons. And a number of people called in, African-American people called in, and did not want these people released at any time, anytime soon. Some of that, you know, I attribute to segregation. And segregation, the way it functions, means that African-American middle-class people live in a proximity to disorder and crime sometimes. I don't want to exaggerate that, but live in a direct proximity to sometimes violent criminality that the white middle class simply does not. I think that's part of that. I don't think you can really understand this issue and some of the Black elite's support for incarceration without factoring in the issue of racial segregation, which remains long after the formal defeat of legal de jure Jim Crow segregation. It's still a deeply rooted sociological fact of American life. I was a little surprised Forman didn't mention that as a kind of factor behind why the Black middle class is like this. I suppose it's just sort of assumed in his book. I mean, he knows that. Probably most of his audience kind of knows that. But I think it deserved to be teased out a little bit more about why it's like that.
So here we are, 40 years distant from much of the political situation that James Forman Jr. describes in his book. And the cutting edge of the Black political movement is Black Lives Matter and a confrontation with the state and its police.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So here we are, this surrender, so to speak, wrapped in the rhetoric of civil rights to a criminal justice lockdown. And here we are all these decades later, and this racist Frankenstein mass incarceration monster that was hatched out of that period is itself now the cutting edge of the civil rights struggle in this country and coast to coast, nationwide. I mean, this is true in Minneapolis. It's true in Cincinnati. It's true down in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's true out on the West Coast. This is, of course, a nationwide system. That's very poignant and interesting to reflect upon all these years later.
That was historian and activist Paul Street, whose latest book is titled They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy.
Earlier this month, Black Agenda Report published an article by Dr. Jaki Issa and Reggie Mabry, which maintained that the reparations movement is dead in the U.S. and will stay dead until activists change their legal strategy. Courts have rejected previous suits for reparations for the descendants of Black people enslaved in the United States. Issa and Mabry maintain that it does no good to bring suits against slavery because slavery was legal in the United States for most of the nation's early history. The best way for Black people to get a favorable ruling in court, they say, is to challenge the U.S. government's failure to stop the illegal importation of Africans after the international slave trade was outlawed in 1808. Cam Howard is a veteran activist in the reparations movement. He's on the legislative commission of NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, and he sits on the steering committee of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. Howard is organizing a campaign to put a reparations measure on the ballot in Chicago. He's aware of Dr. Issa and Reggie Mabry's criticism of previous reparations legal strategies.
I'm not in disagreement with the idea of suing for a protected class, in this case, Africans who were imported or kidnapped or human trafficked, whatever term they want to use, who were stolen from Africa after the United States outlawed, made it illegal to import Africans into this country via the so-called transatlantic slave trade. So I understand the argument, and I'm not against that argument. That is not novel. as they think is novel. It's not novel. There are others who are bringing actions around the piracy issue of America and Britain and France entering in the trade via the acts of piracy and bringing suits against that. Dr. Claude Anderson is also looking at a protected class that would be Africans who were enslaved by indigenous nations, Africans who were partial so-called black Indians who were had half Indians living on those reservations, and also free blacks that were also living in those territories where the indigenous nations were supposed to have given Africans at the time of the end of the Civil War tracts of land. I think it was 120 acres, tracts of land, as well as other remedies that they were given from the United States government at the conclusion of the slave trade. Those were also supposed to have been given to Africans on those lands. And they colluded with a government official department to hide Africans and to deny Africans those rights. And so Dr. Claude Anderson has been raising the issue around suing for a protected class of Africans. So it's not novel. In fact, he has also gotten even further around the issue of standing, unlike the position that these two authors are taking, that that issue cannot be dealt with, that we cannot look at slavery because the Supreme Court ruling says that we are too far removed, 100 years or more. But I think that Dr. Anderson has also gotten past that issue already. There's some other things that he's working on that has yet to be litigated, but the issue of standing, I believe he has already successfully met that challenge. So I have an issue with the notion that this is the only way that reparations can be achieved.
Well, Dr. Issa and Reggie Mabry seem to be content to accept the court's verdict and that slavery was legal and therefore not challengeable, except in the case of those Africans who were imported after it was outlawed.
No, that's one of my biggest contentions with this logic. I do understand this as a tactical issue that we will address, or they will address, a particular set of laws that were violated. I understand that. But we have to go back to the original, is that slavery, the transatlantic slave trade and slavery, was never legal under international norms and under international laws at, before, during, or after the time. It was only a small component, a minority of nations in Europe who colluded together and created some rules amongst themselves on how to engage in these international crimes. And so these were rules that they created amongst themselves, but were outside of international law. And so because we've been taught that whatever white people do, that they have the authority on law. No, those were rules amongst criminals. And we have to go back to international standards and say all of these, there was never a time when this was legal. There was never a time when the transatlantic slave trade was legal. It was some rules established among Europeans up until 1808, in the case of America, then they changed the rules for themselves, and Britain had changed it around that same time. But it was never legal under international standards, international law. And there's a book and a professor of international law out of Vienna, Dr. Nora Wittmann, who wrote a brilliant book on this, and where she researched international law from a historical perspective, dating all the way back to Kemet, Egypt, and coming up through the times before Christ and after Christ, even up to the so-called transatlantic slave trade. And these things that were committed were never legal. So we can argue from the standpoint that it was legal up until 1808, and then it was illegal because America said it was not legal at that time, that it was then illegal. It was never legal to deny the humanity of African people. It was never legal to go into sovereign states and violate the sovereignty of those states. That was never legal. It was never legal to forcibly extract the labor out of people who had engaged in no crimes or engaged in no attack on another nation or foreign nation. It was never legal to deny the humanity of a people, and certainly the type of brutal behavior, the rape and the type of things that were done to our children. That was never legal under international norms and international standards. So I disagree that we should base our total strategy on arguing on the point that part of these crimes were legal and part of these crimes were illegal. So that's my major contention. But I do understand it from a tactical standpoint of trying to meet out a win in the courts.
Certainly, since World War II, there has been established a whole body of law backed up by institutions and covenants on human rights and the concept of violations of folks' human rights and crimes against humanity. And yet it seems that Dr. Issa and Reggie Mabry don't subscribe to any of those human rights doctrines.
Right. They're basing everything on law, Supreme Court, U.S. law, prior to and after the abolition of the slave trade in the U.S. They are not looking at current standards of international law, especially what came out of Durban, where you had 193 nations, with the exception of two nations, agree that slavery, slave trade, colonialism, apartheid, or crimes against humanity, and always should have been so. In fact, always was so, according to the research of Nora Vittman. It was never a time again that these were not crimes against humanity. And so to argue now to ignore this new standing, this new international, what we call statutory law, I would raise it up to statutory law, that what took place throughout the Americas, throughout the United States history, the British, when the British came here in 1619, pre the British, when the Spanish were here in 1515, around in Florida, when the French was here all the way up the Mississippi from Louisiana to Canada, all of that were crimes. There was never a time again when those were not crimes. And the international law and the international covenants that America has signed, the International Covenant for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination that they've signed, who also upholds that these were criminal acts and that lays the foundation for reparations for all of the history, not just for a certain class or a certain group at a certain time.
Yes, isn't there an obligation among activists not just to fashion strategies just to get into this court or that venue, but to advance civilization and the concept of human rights in the world?
Exactly, exactly. And so we're going to go with this strategy, and even if it wins, it does not remove the stain of enslavement off this nation. It does not advance, as you say, human rights. It doesn't advance reparatory justice globally. It is a victory, and it's one that I think should be fought for, but it is not the ultimate goal. It's just to have some resources going to some group of people for a period of harms that were done. We need to clean this whole system and repair ourselves totally, not just people of African descent in America, but, this is a global struggle. And so when we craft strategy, we have to be looking at all African people in the context of whatever strategy we're taking. And that's, again, not to say that we don't, have some tactical victories, like what we're trying to do with corporations in various cities and institutions in various cities. We do go after that, but we do it in the context that these were crimes against all of African humanity. And though we may have resources targeted to a certain segment in a certain location, they are for the benefit of moving this entire struggle to its ultimate end, which is the global repair of people of African descent and return to us our dignity, our humanity, and our sovereign status. And finally, I just want to say that they quote these federal rulings in the DJ Farmer case, but there was a federal ruling here a year earlier here in Chicago with a case that was targeted toward corporations and institutions, Aetna Insurance and others, where the judge also held that we didn't have standing. But he also concluded by saying that it was a political issue, meaning that the legislative and executive bodies had to address this. And that's why we pushed for an executive order or commission. That's why we pushed for state, local, and federal law around reparations. And what Charles Barron has introduced, what the new revised bill that Congressman Conyers has introduced, and what we're doing in Chicago around referendums, all seek to put the ball back in the political area, but we're not saying that the legal area should not be pursued also. We say that there are four strategic areas: political, legislative, mobilization, and internationalizations. And there's work being done in all these areas. And that's, again, why I couldn't understand why these gentlemen were saying reparations was dead when there's so much work going on and have been going on since 2008, since 2001, really, with the World Conference Against Racism, but certainly post-2008 when Obama was elected and this ruling, there's been a ton of work being done and some victories being made in the reparations movement since that time.
That was Cam Howard of the Black is Back Coalition, which will hold its national conference in Chicago, August 12th and 13th.
Haitian political analyst Pascal Robert is a contributor to Black Agenda Report. Robert recently appeared on the podcast Dead Pundits Society. He said that for the first time in history, Black people in the United States are operating in a political space to the right of white progressives.
This is what happens to follow this neoliberal Obama-Hillary Clinton model of rendering our Black politics to a faction of the Democratic Party that's fundamentally reactionary, was designed to basically encapsulate the Black community and destroy it, if you want to call it a Black community, with policies from, you know, three strikes you're out and the mass incarceration to the subprime mortgage crisis and everything else. And this is what Black people like Joanne Reed are sending the Black community to force their hopes on. The Root and all these other publications and all these other Black elite-led Black misleadership, Black petite bourgeois organizations, fraternities, sororities, the Links, the National Organization of Negro Women, because they are the Black misleadership class that misleads the Black community into politics that is going to destroy Black people, they are forcing Black people into politics that work in a direct opposition to what Black people need, which is a class-based challenge to capitalism to redistribute wealth because Black people are disproportionately poor. And anything that does not do that is basically just circle jerk.
Let's talk about public sector trade unions. It seems to me, you know, if you want to talk about how to help real people, real poor and working class people, you know, public sector trade unions are disproportionately filled with women of color. And so, you know, it seems to me that's one of the most important things. So let's lay out a positive case. What do we need to do? Where are some of the areas that we need to work on to develop power?
Well, I'm a big advocate of unions. I mean, first of all, Black people are disproportionately the most unionized demographic in the United States. A larger percentage of Black people are unionized than white people in this country. Unions are basically the key to stable economic development, stable income, stable pensions and health care. I've had Black people say that. Well, unions are racist. I would make the argument, if you want to use this quote-unquote chic rhetoric of anti-blackness, if you are anti-union, you are anti-Black. Because more Black people per capita are involved in unions that's providing stable labor to Black folk than there are Black people in college. That is where the Black community needs to focus on, is having economic paradigms like unions that provide more equity in terms of dollar for dollar what you get for your work and job security. So public sector unions, private sector unions, trying to basically fight for 15, trying to create a paradigm. I'm a fan of universal basic income. I'm a fan of having a cooperative economic model where the public and workers' cooperatives owned a third of the actual shareholders of private corporations. Why can't we have one-third of all private corporations over $5 million in profit be one-third owned by the private originators of the business entity, one-third owned in the public trust for shares for citizens of the United States and workers of that company, and one-third owned by the government to make sure there's no abuse of power by that corporation with, again, a non-interest-based, equity-based lending paradigm. At least you go get a mortgage for $100,000 instead of paying a fixed interest rate that makes the bank a parasite, tell them that you're going to get a percentage of the increase in market value of the house when I sell the house. Wow, what's so impossible about it?
Any final parting words about some of the emphases that you would like to see on the left today?
To Joanne Reed, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and all those other Negroes who have a problem with Black people talking about class, I have a very simple statement, and I can say this as a Haitian and someone who lives as an African in the African-American community in the United States. There is not a place in the world where you cannot find that Black people from Haiti to Harlem have not been sold out by class. They're class traitors in the Black community. And until Black people realize that they have to confront their class traitors in the Black community, they will never be free from white oppression.
That was political analyst Pascal Robert.
Back in 1978, nine members of the MOVE organization were sentenced to life in prison in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. 7 years later, in 1985, the cops bombed the MOVE residence, killing 11 people, including 5 children. The surviving members of the MOVE 9 remain in prison. On August 5th, in Brooklyn, New York, an all-day event will be held at the House of the Lord Church under the heading, 39 Years is Too Long, Free the MOVE 9. MOVE Minister of Communications Ramona Africa spoke with Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier. She says the August 5th event will feature more than just speeches.
The art show is first from 2 to 4 p.m. at the House of the Lord Church, 415 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. It is the first professional art show concerning MOVE. A sister named Sophia Dawson, a tremendous artist, has done a number of pieces on MOVE, and they are spectacular. And she's going to be exhibiting that artwork. The other part of the program is from 5 to 8 p.m. at the same location, House of the Lord Church, 415 Atlantic Avenue. And that part of the program is various speakers speaking on MOVE 9 being imprisoned 39 years unjustly, despite the innocence of the MOVE 9. And that unjust, incredible sentence of 30 to 100 years each, just adding salt to the wound, with the parole board absolutely refusing to parole my family. My brother Delbert saw the parole board in June of this year, and just recently, about a week and a half ago, got his answer, which was to be denied parole, and he got what's called a five-year hit, meaning that they will not see him again for 5 years. And that is just completely unacceptable, completely unacceptable. And we will also be talking about things that people can do and how people can be involved in pressuring the Pennsylvania Parole Board about our family. The Pennsylvania Parole Board is only doing what they're doing, denying our family parole, is because they feel like they can get away with it. And it's our responsibility to show them that they can't get away with it, that we are watching, and we're not going to stop until they release our innocent family members from prison.
And the MOVE 9 have an online petition that people can sign to express their support as well. Could you just speak a little bit on that petition, as well as maybe elaborate a bit on how the parole board has represented one of the main roadblocks to the MOVE 9 being released?
Well, the only roadblock, because they can make the decision to parole MOVE people, you know? So they are the roadblock. In terms of the petition, a lot of times people think that petitions are not effective, but they are. They can be, the more people sign them and make it an issue, they can be effective. For the Pennsylvania Parole Board to see that so many people, not just in Pennsylvania, but across this country and worldwide, we have supporters across the globe. And when they see the signatures from these people and see that these people internationally are writing them, faxing them about the MOVE 9, that puts pressure on them.
The question of conflict of interest has been raised in recent months around Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. Similarly, the case of the MOVE 9 is rife with conflict of interest issues. Could you speak on some of that?
Absolutely. If people look into the background of parole board members who are appointed by the governor, you will find that most of them have backgrounds in law enforcement or as prosecutors. That is definitely a conflict of interest when the issue at hand is the murder of a police officer. Now, our family is innocent, but the charge alone and the conviction makes these parole board officials with that background in law enforcement and the prosecutor's office, it automatically prejudices them against MOVE people or anybody charged with such crimes, even though these prosecutors have gotten convictions. I mean, the numbers are astronomical. And people have sat in prison for decades, 20, 30, 40, some 50 years, only to have to be released when new evidence comes forth to show that the person is actually innocent and sat in prison all these decades. But yet, the parole board, the prosecutors, all feel at liberty to take the attitude that they're infallible, that they know what they're doing, that if they say it's so, then it's so. If they get a conviction, then the person is guilty. But their record speaks to the arrogance of that with all of the people that they have wrongfully convicted. You know, a conviction is not synonymous with guilt. And there is overwhelming evidence in the case of my family, just like there's overwhelming evidence in the case of Lumia, that flies in the face of a conviction, a guilty verdict. But they don't care. They don't care about guilt or innocence. They just want to punish MOVE and Lumia. You know, that's the bottom line here.
Right. And even if we leave aside all of the ballistic evidence, et cetera, that points away from the MOVE family and the MOVE house, it still is plainly clear to anyone that nine people can't shoot and kill one person. So on its face, this case on that level seems completely absurd. After the conviction of the MOVE nine, what was the public response? Was there widespread outrage at this conviction?
Yes, there was widespread outrage, but what people don't seem to realize, it's fine to be outraged, but we have to turn that outrage into action or it means nothing. It means nothing. Officials don't care about people being outraged. They don't. Unless you show them clearly in a way that they cannot ignore that you are outraged. Words don't mean anything to them. And that's what we really, the people really have to understand and commit themselves to being involved on some level in the work to get this system off our back. We
got to
do it.
As a former political prisoner and someone whose family members are presently political prisoners, can you just speak to the importance of communicating with political prisoners as well as visiting them?
It is very important. MOVE people and Lumia, and I'm sure several other political prisoners are well-known and people write them and visit them. But for those that are not as well known, getting letters and getting visits is very important. It's very important. It raises the inmates' spirits, you know? It lets them know that they are not forgotten. And that means a lot when you're sitting in a cell for 20, 30 years, 40 years. It's very easy to think that you're forgotten, that the work you've done means nothing to people. So letters and visits, it's very important.
I've heard you speak to the fact that the actual intentions of those law enforcement officials that raided the Move House in 1978, that there was no intention to arrest there and that their goal was to kill the members of the Move family. Why do you think it's so important for all of us to register that message from 78?
You have cops who are out there who testified that they emptied their guns, reloaded, and emptied their guns again in corners where they heard babies crying because of the tear gas and the water and the heat of August. It made it basically impossible to see in our basement, August 8th of 78. Now, the other thing that clarifies this point is, what were they out there for? And I say this about the bombing in 1985. What were they out at our house for? Were we wanted at either situation for murder, rape, robbery, drug pushing, child molestation, anything like that? No. In 78, they said that they wanted us out of our house, our home, okay? They wanted to evict us. In 85, they said that we were bad neighbors, that some neighbors had complaints about us. Now, people need to ask themselves, is what they did justifiable in an eviction or a neighbor's complaint about another neighbor? Does that justify what they did? No, it doesn't. So people should not have any trouble understanding that there is more to this story than what they're saying. This was not about an arrest.
Yes, and given the longevity that MOVE has demonstrated over these decades now, could you speak to the difference between resistance and sustained resistance?
Well, the bottom line is people don't really have a choice but to demonstrate that commitment to resistance, that consistency. And for people who think they do have a choice whether to fight back, defend themselves, speak out, then they're really hallucinating. Because whether you resist or not, you can be a victim of this system, and most likely will be. Amadou Diallo up there in New York, Eric Garner, the list goes on and on and on of people who were not resisting, wasn't out there at a demonstration saying, you know, down with this rotten system, or anything like that, but victimized just the same. So people need to understand that the only way to secure yourself and your family is to do the work necessary to back this system off of you. As long as it exists, then nobody is safe. Nobody. Whether you're so-called guilty of anything or not. And MOVE understands that very clearly. And that's why, no matter what the system have come at us with over the years, we still keep fighting back.
That was Ramona Africa, Minister of Communications for the MOVE organization.
Charles Diggs is locked up in the Pennsylvania prison system. He wrote an essay for Prison Radio about how best to return to society all of its missing citizens, like himself. Charles Diggs asked the question, why are so many among the missing?
American prisons on any given day have over 3 million or more women and men in jail. These prisons are local, county, statewide. Also, the federal government has prisons in every state across America. In some states, you have 4 or 5 prisons, state prisons and federal prisons. In California, Florida, Texas, you have the largest prison populations. And some states have even stopped building more prisons and are trying to find ways to release more people from their prisons. I think one of the deepest problems that we face is that the mandatory sentencing that carries a heavy burden on the taxpayer, and that is one of the causes that maintains the large prison population. The question should be asked, why is America imprisoning more people than any other country in the world? South Africa used to be the largest country to imprison its citizens. Reminded, South Africa had a system of apartheid. Maybe that's the reason. And also America one time had a system of apartheid. Another question should be asked, should we keep people in prison the length of time that we presently do? It is my opinion that we keep too many people in prison for too long. And as long as we've got these mandatory sentencing and not releasing people at the other end, you're forced to build more and more prisons. Millions of families are disrupted and broken up because of this large prison population. One of the things that drives prison population is our large unemployment. It produces stress in the family and the community. And whenever a person or community is under extreme stress, they begin to function in ways that are illegal. They begin to do things that are self-destructive. Substance abuse takes place. So this long imprisonment, being driven by economic insecurity, that causes many of this nation's mental health problems, and we're labeling these problems criminal behavior. But in actuality, it's not. Many of our neuroscientists are beginning to bear witness to that particular statement that I just made. They're realizing that the frontal lobe is undeveloped in many of the men and women that are in prison, and many of your crimes are being committed by people who are under 25. And that is the period of time where you're developing, you're learning ways, you're learning who you are, and you're beginning to mature between that age, 18 to 25, but it's not fully developed even at 25, some scientists say. The point is that all of this equals to a massive imprisoned population. Now what has happened with these long sentences, the prisons are turning gray. Some of your state's prisons are 15-20% over the age of 50. And now that's cost some more money to maintain the health of these prisoners. So the question should also bring us to the point where we should, as a society, try to find ways and means to reduce the prison population in order to heal the communities and the families. Because many men and women in prison now, they're in their 50s and their 60s, and they're pretty mature and develop themselves. And I would think that that would be a large waste of capital to remain in prison when one has become mature and understands the system, understand themselves, and understand their commitment to society. So I would like to end on that note that it matters the welfare, the care of people in prison and their return to society. And the societies should begin to question why we're keeping people in prison so long. And then they have to return again. So we want them to return, with a welcome. the society taking them in and helping them to readjust. So I think this question should be put out there throughout the country. We should start questioning this massive imprisoned incarceration. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.